Well, thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Jack, for a great introduction to this session. When John Snyder first contacted me about giving a presentation in this session, he asked me, could I talk about carbon partitioning? And so most of what I'm going to talk about today is really some work that we've been doing in Arabidopsis. I realize this is a cotton meeting, but probably most of you are familiar with this little weed, which is a common model system. But what I want to talk about is how we can use, or how in my lab in particular, we've been using Arabidopsis to try to figure out how the plant transports sucrose from the photosynthetic leaves to the growing sink organisms, sink organs. And can we use this knowledge to cotton to improve source-to-sink relationships? So I want to cover initially the very basics of phloem transport, phloem loading and phloem transport. And then I'm going to talk about some more specifics on some efforts that we've done and also what some people have done in some other labs, and talk about how this can potentially be applied to cotton. And in the last couple of minutes of my talk, I'm going to kind of shift gears completely and talk about some work that we've been doing looking at cotton architecture, and specifically, and again relating to the very last thing that Jack was saying, you know, the plant can respond to how much source material it actually has to make its sink output. And I think we've got some very interesting tools here which will benefit that. So in my introductory slide here, we basically have a schematic diagram of some of the things that I'm going to be talking about. Essentially, this is what the plant does right now. The carbon material that's produced in the source leaves is spread out among many sinks. And ultimately, what we're interested in doing is concentrating that material into specific organs and tissues, and in most cases, that's going to be the fiber. So first of all, let's do a quick schematic review of phloem loading and phloem transport. This is a molecular biologist's view of what a plant looks like. And up here in the source mesophyll, of course, this is where we have photosynthesis taking place. And the process that I'm mostly interested in is taking place at this interface here. So the sucrose that is being produced in these photosynthetic mesophyll cells, it's released to the apoplasm, the cell wall space surrounding the phloem tissue, and then into the phloem, sucrose transporters take that sucrose, accumulate it to high concentration, and that starts the hydrostatic pressure, which pushes that phloem sap out to the rest of the plant. As the phloem sap is moving along the transport phloem, in the regions of the plant, such as the stems and the roots, regions that can be classified as the transport phloem, we have an exchange of carbon from the phloem out into flanking tissues, and depending on the source sink needs of the plant, some of that storage tissue can remobilize that sucrose back into the phloem. Okay? And there's been a lot of research done on starch accumulation during the early stages of cotton plant development. And then the main sink tissue that we're talking about here is down here in the release phloem. And in the release phloem, the sugar can be released through the symplasm, and in certain stages of carbon fiber development, that seems to be the major pathway for the sucrose. And then there's also apoplasmic steps, where the sugar is released again into the cell wall space, and the adjacent tissues take that sucrose up by transporters. And that's, of course, what we see happening in the filial tissues in the embryo. So what was some of the work that we did in Arabidopsis? Well, in Arabidopsis, the main transporter that is involved in phloem loading, the name of the gene is AT-SUC2. And if you knock out the AT-SUC2 gene, you get these very, very stunted plants. Okay, so these are plants which, just frankly, they're sitting there in the light, so they can do photosynthesis. But what they cannot do is transport that photoassimilate from the leaves to the growing tissues. So you end up with these very stunted plants, and surrounded by these stunted plants, these are the siblings, which are either segregating wild type or segregating heterozygous, and they're perfectly normal. Now these knockout plants, they accumulate very high levels of both the soluble carbohydrates, glucose, fructose, and sucrose, and also very high levels of starch relative to their wild type counterparts. So one of the questions with this experimental material, one of the questions we wanted to ask was, can we put the sucrose transporters back into the plant? Can we overexpress them to a certain level? And in doing so, can we enhance the transport of the sucrose from the leaves to the growing sinks? So starting off with our wild-type plants and our AT-SUC2 mutant plants, one of the first things that we did was we chose an alternative promoter, a heterologous promoter, which would not have the same level of regulation that the normal AT-SUC2 promoter would have. And that's represented in this slide. And the name of this promoter is COYMVP. It's also highly phloem-specific, and it has approximately the same expression level as the natural AT-SUC2 promoter, but we know that it also has different fine-scale regulation. So using this promoter, we took several different sucrose transporters. We took a couple from Arabidopsis, we took one from corn, and we put these transporters back into this wild-type plant, and we were able to restore the growth of the plant. Okay, so we now have a situation where we can start asking questions about, can we manipulate source-to-sink relationships? So if we can use heterologous promoters and heterologous transporters to complement the AT-SUC2 mutation, and if these promoters and transporters are uncoupled from the natural regulation of phloem loading, which research that I'm not presenting, we know that that is the case, can we use these transporters to hyperload the phloem? Okay, can we use these transporters to pump more sucrose into the phloem? And if we can do that, will this enhance source-to-sink partitioning, and will it potentially increase primary productivity of the plant? Well, the answer to that question, or those questions, is a very definitive maybe. Okay, so what we were able to do, well, what we did see is that the increase of these Arabidopsis plants was not obvious. Okay, we did restore the plants to their wild-type growth level. In this particular assay, we're measuring root length as the metric of interest. There is a slight increase in root length, but it's not a statistically significant increase. So we then went in and we looked in greater detail at some different physiological approaches, mostly using radio-labeled carbon dioxide, which is a very valuable tool for this sort of experiment. So when we photosynthetically label these plants with radioactive carbon dioxide, we do see that the roots of the plants are accumulating more of the label. Okay, so that indicates that even though they're not bigger, they are transporting more sugar to the roots. We can go in and we can sample the phloem sap directly, and when we do that, we can see that there's quite a significant increase in the amount of radio-labeled sucrose in the phloem relative to the wild-type. And we can also do experiments where we measure sucrose uptake into the phloem directly, and in those experiments, we again see that we do get more sucrose into these phloem tissues. So although we don't see an increase in growth in this particular experiment, we do have strong evidence that we are indeed hyperloading the phloem. So where can we take this experiment from here? Well, again, this isn't work done, this isn't cotton work, and it's not work that was done in my laboratory. It's actually work that was done quite a long time ago in the laboratory of John Patrick, working out of Australia. And his model system was pea. And what he likes to do is he likes to take the pea plant, and he takes sucrose transporters and so on, and he expresses them at the seed coat. And what he found, this study was done quite a long time ago in 2002, but he found that if you overexpress sucrose transporters in the cotyledonary tissue of these developing peas, then you do get... that was unexpected. Okay. When you overexpress the sucrose transporters in the cotyledons, then those cotyledons, they take up sucrose faster from the environment, and those cotyledons grow faster in the intact plant. And so, of course, what's happening here is that in this diagram, the sucrose is coming in from the phloem, it's entering the seed coat, and then from the seed coat, it's transported into the apoplasmic space, and then from the apoplasmic space, the increase in sucrose transport is accumulating more sugar into those cotyledons. So can we apply these two different types of technologies to the cotton plant? Essentially, the work that we did in Arabidopsis, I like to call this a push approach. We're trying to push more sugar into the phloem. And combining that with the sort of work that John Patrick does, he's taking a pull approach. Okay, so can you pull more sucrose into the sink organs? And in this schematic, we're looking at possible ways of doing that. So we've got a source tissue down here where we can potentially manipulate the different sucrose transporters. Along the transport phloem, we can potentially manipulate the various sucrose transporters to control the amount of sugar that goes into and out of transient storage reserves. And then in the developing seed itself, we can potentially control the amount of sugar that is made available to the embryo via apoplasmic transport, or we can control the amount of sugar that's made available to the fiber by both apoplasmic and symplastic transport. And so when we look at the fiber development, how does the sugar get from the phloem into the fiber? Well, this is a figure that was published by Yongling Ruan, also working out of Australia. And what he did back in 2001, again quite an old paper, is he took a detailed look at what's happening at the base of the fiber as it's developing, with specific regard to the major transporters, the sucrose transporters and the potassium transporters. And these are the transporters which are going to give the hydrostatic pressure. Well, they're going to do two things. The sucrose transporters, they're going to give sucrose for cell wall synthesis and growth, of course, but they're also going to provide the hydrostatic pressure, which is going to push the elongation of that fiber. So in his experiments, 0 to 9 days after anthesis, the sucrose and potassium transporters were expressed, but the plasmodesmata at this interface were also very open. Okay, so in these very early stages of development, most of the sucrose was coming into the fiber very quickly through plasmodesmata. And then between days 10 and 15 post-anthesis, something pretty interesting happens. The plasmodesmata themselves are transiently blocked. Okay, so that symplastic pathway is blocked, and the sucrose and potassium transporters are turned on to a higher level. Okay, so this, during this stage, this is the rapid elongation phase, and presumably that additional sucrose and additional potassium is driving elongation. And then, after 16 days post-anthesis, when the cell has basically expanded to the length that it's going to expand and it really starts to pack on that carbohydrate for cell wall, secondary cell wall biosynthesis, the transporters are again downregulated, the plasmodesmata open again, and that allows rapid transport through the symplastic pathway. So with the knowledge of these developmental processes, let me go back to this slide. I think with some, either if you want to do it through breeding with specific selection of these different transporters from natural populations, or if you wanted to do it more of an experimental transgenic approach, I think there's a lot of potential in direct manipulation of the phloem transport stream and the apoplasmic and symplastic pathways within the developing seed to target where that biomass is being distributed. What I'd like to do now is shift gears a little bit, more than a little bit actually, and talk about some of the work that we've been doing in looking at the development of cotton architecture. And the very last slides, I am going to bring this back to the concepts of carbon partitioning and how these particular experiments can contribute, potentially, to our understanding of how the plant handles its available carbon. Well, for several years now in my laboratory, with the support of Cotton Incorporated, we've been looking at a family of genes that are called the Setz genes. Okay, so it doesn't really matter what that stands for. But these are the class of genes which are the flowering locus T or FT-like genes. So, Florigen, you know, this classical flowering hormone, we now know is encoded by the flowering locust T gene, and it's a small 19 kilodalton protein which moves through the phloem from the source leaves to the developing meristem and converts that meristem into a floral structure. So this class of genes, cotton has about 8 of these things in the diploid genome, and we've been looking at all of them to try to figure out what they do. And the method that we use to do this is we use viruses that were developed by one of them, cotton leaf crumple virus, was developed in the laboratory of Dr. Candace Hagler. Hi, Candace. And another one that we use is tobacco rattle virus, which is an RNA virus. And so we've been using these two viruses in combination. We use the cotton leaf crumple virus for gene delivery. It works very well for that. And we use the tobacco rattle virus vector when we want to silence a gene, because we found that in direct side-by-side comparisons, data that I'm not presenting here, but we have found that for silencing the TRV, it's very effective very early on, but the silencing is lost as the plant gets stronger, gets older. So different viruses can be used depending on what you want to do and when you want to do it. In this particular experiment, we're using the cotton leaf crumple virus to deliver expression of Arabidopsis FT. And what we're representing in this slide is this is an uninfected plant where the round circles represent the developing fruit and the arrows developing are new flowers. Now, in this one over here, this has been treated with the FT. And in this case, we no longer have new flowers forming, okay? So the buds, the termini of these sympodia have all terminated into determinant structures so that the crop is more synchronized because you do not have development of new flowers. This is a sympodia of Texas 701. Texas 701, incidentally, is a photoperiodic line. And what I want to emphasize here is this cluster of flowers that's forming right at the terminus of that sympodia. And I'll also emphasize that these are under long day conditions. So normally this plant would not be flowering at all under these conditions. So by controlling these different flowering factors, we can control, to a certain extent, the structure of the plant and the determinacy of the plant. So this is wild type Delta Pine 61. This is a Delta Pine 61 expressing the FT gene to moderate levels, and it's more determinant. And I'll draw your attention to this guy over here, because this is an extremely determinant plant. And in a close-up over here, what you can see, well, not can't see it that clearly, but essentially what we've got is we've got 5 leaves, and then once the plant reaches that 5-leaf stage, every vegetative meristem on this plant converts to a floral fate. Okay, so we have the monopodial termini has converted to a flower. All of the axillary locations have converted to flowers. Jack mentioned a plant that does this in the reverse orientation. It's the monopodial termini that terminates first. And then, as the what I interpret to be apical dominance, as apical dominance is lost down the plant, those new meristems that normally would grow out into a branch grow out into flowers as well. And you can't see it here, but the final flowers that we develop are at the cotyledonary node. Okay, so if you want to talk about node of first fruiting branch, what is that, 0, minus 2? Okay, so just as my sum up light is on here. So just as a final thing here, how are these useful? These things are producing pretty healthy bowls, to be honest, but we're not really expecting this to be out in the field anytime soon. But one thing that's quite interesting is that the leaves that this thing produces are very thick. They're very deep green. And they do produce some pretty healthy bowls. Okay, so even these things are extreme, they have extreme levels of sink strength. They have a very limited amount of source tissue. But the source tissue that they do have is really turning everything on to pump out as much as it possibly can. And so projecting forward and projecting to these, you know, systems biology and genomics and transcriptomics and stuff, I think that this type of extremely determinant plant could be a very valuable exploratory tool for finding out how the plant responds to extreme sink source differences. And there's some very initial data here where we've looked at the changes in CO2 exchange rate and photosystem 2 activity with our infected plants having about twice as much as the wild-type plants. And I'm about to get thrown off the stage, so thank you for your time.
We've got time for one real quick question, if we'd like.
Just one real fast thing. I really have to thank Dr. Roisin McGarry, who has been the research associate in my lab, who has driven most of the plant architecture in a most professional way. Right, thanks, Candace. The question is, would we expect the sucrose transport, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, would we expect the sucrose transporters to really have an effect if they already have a strong sink? And then the second half of that was, did we look at Arabidopsis seeds? The first question, I mean, the answer is, my hypothesis would be yes. I do think that, the plant regulates stuff. The plant regulates the amount of sucrose transporter that it produces. And if we ask it to express a little bit more, I think there will be an effect. Now, there might be other things we have to do. We might have to, so sucrose transporters, that's only the uptake step. But there's also the release step. But we know what does that. We know that that's carried out by a different type of transporter called sweets. And so by having a model of how this works, we can, one step at a time, see which transporters do what, and then add on to that different activities, which is why Arabidopsis is such a great model for this sort of thing and why cotton would be kind of a little more difficult to work with. The second part is, no, we did not look at seeds. Largely, we look at roots because they're just a lot easier to look at in Arabidopsis. You get a linear metric rather than a three-dimensional metric. And any seed is a, it basically has a genetically predetermined size. And so just giving it more carbon might not necessarily change the size of the organ. I think we have to look at some other things to do that.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, thank you.